Hello, hello, and welcome to The Thin Blue Mind. Each week we will be looking at current policing issues and topics within the UK. Our regular panel consists of Steve Bradshaw, who is a TV and theatre actor, Richard Horton, author, and me, Dave Thomas, broadcaster. What we all have in common is over 80 years of combined police service. Now retired, we will be providing opinion and insights from the unique position of having been there and done it. Steve spent the majority of his service on firearms before being promoted to inspector, where he was a force incident manager. Richard was a career detective before going back into uniform as a response sergeant. Myself, I spent the majority of my service on the Rhodes Policing Unit before going into CID and Child Protection. You may not agree with everything we say, but we will make you think.
The Thin Blue Mind with Bradshaw, Horton and Thomas. Policing insights and opinion.
Well, hello, hello, and welcome to this week's episode of The Thin Blue Mind. Now, last week we had a bit of a giggle, didn't we? This week we're going back to more serious matters, and I suppose it goes back on the back of the recent podcast we did on the HMIC report on poor performance within the police. But we got to thinking, and there's more to it than just austerity and systems, so we decided to look at police leadership today and also the sort of associated topics of well-being and what affects well-being. So we're going to have an interesting conversation. We'll try and keep it on track. There's a lot to cover. I suppose we start with the premise of what makes a good leader.
And a howling silence descends upon the room.
Well, that's because probably it's quite a subjective thing, or it should be quite a subjective thing, and it should be from within you. And, you know, you ask me for a 10-point plan about what is good leader, which you can apply to anybody. Well, you can't, can you? And I think that's where people sometimes fall over. Really good cop who wants to get on and become a leader, who then thinks they have to be a certain way. You change yourself to be something else, or try and have a different personality, or
and you can't. And you're right about that, Steve. I'll make no bones about it. I had a period where I was a temporary sergeant on the response team that I ended up being a substantive sergeant on, and I was bloody awful. That's the truth of it, because I was trying to be what I wasn't. And one of the pieces of advice I'd been given to people that I would speak to afterwards when they were embarking on this journey from constable to sergeant was, what you bring to the role is actually yourself. You can't bring something that isn't yourself to the role. You've got to be authentic, I guess. But on the first attempt at doing it, I did. And I think a lot of people do. They try and be the perfect sergeant or the tick box sergeant. And you can't do that. You're always going to fall flat on your face. Be yourself. That's the first thing.
The three of us have had leadership roles, I would say, in the police. Me and you, Richard, in a rank perspective, but Dave, from a specialist department role as well. I always find that gets overlooked. Somebody will come to you and go, I don't know what to do here. And you can shape their interpretation, not only of approaching people from specialist departments, but obviously your department as well. So there's a lot of leadership and guidance and mentoring and tutoring kind of role that people can take on from specialist departments.
Just listening to you both talking about like the sergeant's rank, for me it's the keystone of everything is the sergeant role, and everything leads from that, from upwards and downwards. And you know, poor leadership affects well-being, and poor well-being affects performance. So it's crucial that the sergeant in post is the right person for that role. And it brings us on to promotion processes, doesn't it, I suppose, and everything else that's within the organisation that makes life that little bit more difficult, that affects people's well-being. Computer systems that are there to make your life easier are actually making your life harder. And I do feel sorry for the sergeants. Not everybody that, in my experience, has been a sergeant should have been one. But having said that, the support for new sergeants is, from what I could see, pretty woeful.
I got really lucky. When I came back on a substantive role on a team I supervised before, I had two really good established sergeants, different in their ways, but both excellent. And I was able to take things from their practice, the mentoring, really, as much as anything. And one was very much down crime side, one was very much down custody and process side. They both had a good way with them and a good rapport with the team. And I just learned and borrowed from that, and that helped me build what I was as a sergeant. that mentoring thing, I think if I'd just been lobbed in a single sergeant shop, it would have been a lot more difficult for me to develop as a sergeant. But having two experienced sergeants to bounce off and then to build myself up, that really helped.
British Army recognised that one of the ways we learn to become a leader is to copy good practice of others.
Absolutely.
I'd agree with that massively as well. And you know yourself when your first 5 years in the police, you know the people you would go into battle with, and you know the people you won't go to the shop for a pack of polos for. It's just the way they are and the way they motivate you and the way they get the best out of you and pick you up when you're down. And
fairness was important for me as a leader. No whipping boy and no golden child on the team. When it came to the rubbish jobs, bed watches, cell watches, scene watches, the jobs that nobody likes to do. Now, sure, got probationers on the team and they can't drive a response car. They get the lion's share of those. But I tried to make sure that everybody, even the pursuit drivers, the taser people, where possible, once every so often, the fickle finger of fate would point at them as well. And they get the rubbish job, you know, for 3 or 4 hours or whatever. But it kept it kind of fair, if you will. Everybody knew, nobody was excluded from the rubbish jobs on the team. It would come to you sometimes. I used to say to them, into each life some rain must fall. That was one of the ways that I ran the team.
Well, this is all very interesting. We started the podcast with what makes a good leader. You both said, I think, that there isn't really a definitive answer, but listening to your chatting, that you are coming out with things that do make a good leader, and it's very interesting. We look at the Army Doctrine of Leadership, who actually have produced a book on what makes a good leader. It's about 80 pages in length. It's based on John O'Dare's theory of Army leadership, which is written in, the 50s or 60s, so that's how long ago it was. But today, it's still used. Basically breaks down leadership into three things, which is the team, the task, and the individual. It describes what is a good Army leader. Well, they describe a good Army leader as a role model, selfless, a figurehead, and a person who people want to follow. So that's what they are. And then what does a good Army leader know? Well, they must have the technical skills, decision-making and communication in order that they can be trusted. And you can only lead if you know your own skills. So onto the practical level, what do Army leaders do? It's broken down into three things. So building the team to complete a task, but the best teams to come together with a shared identity, and they believe it's the right thing for the team to achieve. If they believe in their task, they're more willing to give something up to achieve it. Also, looking after the team, leader has to be selfless, puts the needs of the team before themselves, and makes it obvious you care and protect the team. Prove you're in it for the team rather than just yourself. Senior leaders need to grasp that they may not see others that often, so the interaction they have is crucial. So every contact leaves a trace, the old Locard's principle. So if you're not having a good day and you only see your subordinates at once every 3 months and you're a bit choppy with them, that's going to leave an impression, isn't it? So the Army are quite prescriptive about what makes a good leader, and it's this fine balancing act between the needs of the team, the task, and the individual, which I think is very interesting.
I like the idea of, and I refer to it as a whole thing, as trusted decision making. As a sergeant, for example, but it's the same when I'm going to an inspector for a decision. You get into a habit because they routinely make good decisions, and you can get to trust the decisions that they make. I just want to talk a job through with you, Sarge, or somebody will come into the office, Sarge, I need to talk to you about this or the other. What they don't want is on the one hand, on the other hand. Although there's a place for that as you're discussing the job with them, but they actually want a decision and they want to be able to trust in that decision and know that you'll back it up.
What's important though, if you don't have the time to give them the working out for that decision, it's giving them that working out later on for the next time that they call you or the time after that. They know the working out and they know why you got to that answer. Because nothing's ever cut and dried in police, isn't it? We make some very tough and challenging decisions off very, very limited assumptions, never mind fact.
Very frequently.
They need to know that they're going to make a decision for all the right reasons off this limited information. But are they going to get supported by the sergeant?
Well, in 2019, the Home Office did a frontline review, didn't they? I'm guessing that although the recommendations or the summary of what they found is spot on. There may be a bit of lack of trust in for the people who actually produced it, because a lot of police will argue that the government and the austerity are part of the problem, and the gaslighting that the cops seem to suffer. Just to go through the summary of the review, the Discover was a feeling that demand is increasing while capacity is decreasing. General feeling that frontline officers and staff feel undervalued by the wider system. Very true, that, isn't it? A feeling of disconnect between the frontline and senior national decision makers. Again, very true. Profound scepticism and the ability of the frontline to inform change and improvement, so they're not being listened to. Frustrations caused by unnecessary demands on time seem to get in the way of core policing. That's very relevant at the moment. Internally generated demands on time, ineffective IT, scepticism about the authenticity of the emerging wellbeing agenda. Yes, because has anything changed over the last couple of years for those officers on the front line? Feeling that the front line is not afforded sufficient time or space for activities that positively impact on their well-being. And this is the big one for me, time for decompression, adequate debriefing, which is what we've talked about.
What you're talking about there, every single point, I think, was strategic decision-making from strategic leaders level. We're talking quite senior level decisions there from what you've read out. And it's an appreciation of how the demands have changed on the front line. The feeling supported from those above you, are you going to get a ton of bricks or a ton of love?
There's little things that point to how life on the front line has, in my opinion, deteriorated. And it started with refs. Your sergeant always made sure that you had time to get your refs. And then it kind of went on from canteens were closing. So we stopped going to the canteens for refs. So then we started having our refs at our desk. And then that went on to, well, we'll have our refs in our car. And then it went on to not getting refs, and it became the norm. And now cops are working 10 hours with really out getting anything to eat.
Well, and just going to, for example, Morrison's, going to the canteen and grabbing refs, and there might be two or three of you in there, and then there'd be someone with a mobile phone photographing you, photographing where your car's parked. People are going, oh my goodness, cops. Well, the cop's eating on duty. And it's cultural, isn't it? And it's what people expect.
But it became a practice that became unofficially accepted, didn't it? And now nobody shouts up. And comms would shout up. I remember when I was on Section Cracky back in the day, blah, blah, blah. Comms would shout up, can you go to this job? Sergeant shouted, no, examine his refs, send somebody else. That never happens now. Well, it certainly didn't happen in the department I worked on. And now comms are saying, yeah, I appreciate on your rest. Can we diarise this job for you as soon as you finish? And it's just this little drip of pressure and relentlessness of the workload. Just leave cops alone.
That very point you mentioned there about diarising stuff, that stopped in Lancs very recently.
Good. Glad to hear it.
Because diarising of jobs just wasn't getting done because it was getting them off one screen onto another.
Exactly.
And then cops are getting to the end of the shift and going, well, I didn't get time to do that. So we're not really servicing that demand. Plus also, it's you never got touched. When you booked off on refs on your radio or status messaging, you didn't used to get touched, did you? But now, from their perspective, they've got a grade one job and it's on this area. Now I need to try and service it because somebody needs help. It's a really, really difficult situation for the dispatcher and for the sergeant.
It's a difficult situation, isn't it? And the Humberside recently did something, didn't they, where they said to their mental health services, we're giving you notice, we're giving you a year's notice that we are not going to mental health jobs and you've got a year to sort it out. Their mental health services in that area agreed that, yes, we are the best people to deal with mental health. And that freed Humberside up then to do what they should be doing, I suppose, and become one of the best performing forces. I've not read the report yet, it should be interesting to read.
Because they can deal with crime.
Yes.
And the causes of crime and all that.
But it gives cops a breathing space, doesn't it? And that's the, I think that's the biggest thing about well-being in the police, is there's just no time to stop and rest. Like an engine, it's wear and tear. It's going to break.
If there's another thing which people expect from police leadership, it's pushback on their behalf. You mentioned that there wouldn't necessarily be a sergeant coming on the radio saying, actually, they're busy doing something else or they're reffing or, you know, and it's not that urgent, leave them alone. I would do that a lot. If mine needed more time on a job, then I would make sure, even pushing back on the radio with comms, not trying to redeploy them until they're actually gone status free. Because you would get it where they'd be comms to say, oh, they've been at that job for an hour. Surely they must be finished by now. And if they're not, they're not. It's as simple as that. And the other things, again, that fairness agenda, and if your team's not reffing, you're not reffing. I've very seldom got refs other than a sandwich at my desk when I was working, because my team was that busy and I was that busy.
Well, that's the point I'm trying to make. Yeah. Should there be more pushback on that?
And the other one, pushback, if you will, there's always that period when you're on nights and you've got officers that are out on bed watches and scene watches and they need relieving so they get home before a decent time. Now, I was always first in and I was often last out because I'd hang around like a bad smell in the sergeant's office until the morning sergeants had physically deployed someone to relieve mine. And there is that ownership of them, my people. And I'm looking after my people. I'm not letting them be forgotten and left until, you know, an hour after shift ends because the earlies haven't got their act together to replace them on a scene watch or a bed watch.
The feeling that you get that you're being looked after is worth its weight in gold, isn't it?
It's the old saying, isn't it? It's the things people do that you remember, not the things that they say. I remember one particular incident earlier in my career. I was guarding a scene. I was on nights. It was coming up to 7 o'clock. Looking at my watch, 10 past seven, 20 past seven, shouts up, gets hold of the early turn sergeant. Is there someone coming to relieve me? Oh, I didn't realise you were there. That happens so many times and it's infuriating. What's that saying to you? That you're not worth, as a person, you know, you're just left there to do whatever. It's not good for your well-being when things like that happen from people that should be watching your back.
It was a matter of, well, if there's still somebody out there, I ain't going home. And you welcome them back and go, right, you know, how are things? Because then they know that you were looking after them.
Cynically, I suppose, but I used to think also in terms of the giving hand and the taking hand. Now, with the way the police service is, you will always have a lot in the taking hand because you're asking people to work longer, to do harder, to take on responsibility. You know, you're asking the, often officers, you know, it is going to be an hour after your shift ends. It is a rubbish job. You've plenty in the taking hand, and you've always got plenty in there with most officers. Don't be afraid of using the giving hand sometimes. Get somebody off on an early dart, for example. An early dart, just for your done, finishing maybe 10 or 15 minutes before shift end, because they're finished and done. Or if the earlies are coming and they've got sufficient, and you, particularly on the last night, an early's come in, it's not unusual for the sergeant to have a conversation, you know, with the inspectors, can we get ours away 10 minutes early? And just those little things.
Well, that's when it works well, doesn't it? When you know, teams that follow each other and get on well. You know, there has been instances, isn't it, where teams don't get on well. I did a podcast with Will Medding a few years ago, a Lieutenant Colonel in the Army. He's a battalion commander. He has about 500 people under him. And maybe we'll play that podcast next week. It's very interesting. But and we go back to these three things that the Army says, the team, the task and the individual. If you're constantly concentrating on the task, you are writing some pretty big IOUs to the individuals of that team regarding their well-being, and at some point you're going to have to pay back.
That's the taking hand, and it's the giving hand you use for the, you know, we even had a ritual where there was, where we got an early dart, the one officer who would leave first, just like 2 seconds ahead of everybody else, and everybody going, make way for. It's a bit of humour in the team, and it's a bit of ritual in the team if we manage to, you know, bonds everybody together. The other thing to watch out for, no cliques. Where humanly possible, do not allow cliques to build up in your team as a leader, because it will destroy your team really, really quickly. Don't have anybody that you can't pair with anybody else.
The other thing I noticed, and maybe it's not happening now, it certainly didn't used to happen, but if someone within the team would go for promotion and would be acting up, whether as a sergeant or inspector, they would invariably go to a different team and probably a different station, quite possibly a different area altogether. But now people are acting up within the same team, and that must cause some big problems.
It's a big ask. You hope for good, and I got good, which, you know, you're happy about. But it is a big ask for all of us, you know. I remember one particular starting on his first super subbing. Rich, I haven't got a Scooby, what I'm doing. Would it be okay if I just sat and watched and went through the logs and just didn't get involved too much because I'm still fine? Yeah, that's fine.
Well, going back to leadership and one of the key issues brought up by the Home Office report was a general feeling that frontline officers and staff feel undervalued and that there's a disconnect between the frontline and senior decision makers. What do we think of that?
I think that over the last 10 years, I think things have got incredibly better from an engagement point of view with SMTs. And knowing what they do in a day, there are some incredibly hard-working people, especially at chief inspector rank, who have such incredibly long days, stressful days. I know it's a different kind of stress because they're not blue lights whizzing around Preston, etc.
It is the rank that nobody wants to retire in as chief inspector, I've been told. It's the worst of all the ranks because you're getting it from the top and you're getting it from underneath.
Well, having occupied, obviously, the inspector rank for over 10 years and having a very small foray into the world of acting chief inspector, it worked out, and I think it was a very esteemed chief inspector who was force incident commander who said to me, I think the difference between his wage and my wage was a McDonald's a week.
I remember an old DI of mine on promotion saying to me, all I've managed to do, Richard, is to dilute my hourly rate. And when he went from DS to DI... That's exactly how it worked out for the poor fella.
But why do we think the frontline field is this separation then between themselves and
I feel upstairs? That SMT have got more approachable, but that may be a function of being 30 years in the job and from about 25 years on, and knew most of them. At 5 years in, I was perhaps not that comfortable in just wandering up to the carpeted corridor and to say, can I have a word with the chief inspector or the super? But at 25 years in, there was no issue, no hassle about it. They seem more approachable, perhaps because I was more willing to approach them. But I think you're probably right. They have been more approachable. There's been more of chief constables and supers particularly going on parades and explaining what's happening and why it's happening. You know, why we're closing all these stations during austerity, why we're reconfiguring neighbourhood and response during austerity and explaining the burning platform decisions that they were having to make to the rank and file in a fairly open way. I think that's been a good and a newer thing in policing.
Those who deal with strategic stuff to SMT level are looking at the wider, long-term mission goals and plans and adhering to this Home Office, that Home Office circular. You know, we've talked about it before about national crime recording standards and appeal reports. So they're dealing with the strategic stuff when the cops on the ground want the operational stuff dealing with, don't they? They want cars that work. They want cops on the beat with them. They want more people in the parade room with them. And it's the little things, isn't it?
They want to feel that they're also on a strong team that's staying strong and getting stronger and being built, and that they've got a ticket in the lottery for, you know, if I want to diversify off and want to try for armed response, for example, will I get support from my supervision? Will what I do on the front line have filtered its way upstairs sufficiently so they know that I'm good? Are the people advocating for me? Or am I just labouring in a vacuum and my sergeant knows I'm good, my inspector knows I'm good, but no other bugger in the organisation knows that I'm good?
When I was acting chief inspector and I did some force incident commander duties, I'd go around to the Knicks and pop up on parade and say, right, any kind of questions? I'm not your SMT, but I'm kind of your chief inspector for tonight and anyone else above me is on call. You were it from I am the person driving around your division tonight. So you've got any, and it's just visibility. Just trap up at jobs with them.
But it's down to the individuals as well. We're part of this huge organisation, but it stands and falls on the individual. I mean, you know, I'm sure you were saying, Richard, but on nights, on briefings, if it was on traffic, I'd be sat in with the response teams.
Always welcome. When you see the specialist department, the dog handlers, the ARV, the traffic, the TAC ops people, and they come on your parade as well. Always welcome.
Yeah. When I was the night jack, always went on the briefing.
Not many do. There are some that religiously come on briefings. Yeah. But they should do.
Because straight away, as you say, you know, you're a point. When you're night jack, you're a kind of a point of a reference, aren't you? And that can be for anybody from a PC up to inspector. So it's nice just to show your face and say, well, this is who.
And also, and tell me if I'm wrong, but I'm guessing the answer to this. I bet you went on those parades and some constable came to you and said, can I just have a quick chat with you
about
Section 47 assault here? He's got a black eye and a kind of...
And you're happy to help. A lot of people aren't now.
Yeah,
unfortunately.
But why? I don't know. That comes out from supervision because people forget that they were the ones driving that panda around with 6 months in.
I think we do get very siloed, don't we, in the police? You know, I've known it. Yeah, remit's not in my remit as a favour.
Well, you need it because there's so many specialisms now. You need a little bit of siloing.
But there's all these silos working against each other, and I do sometimes think we're our own worst enemy, aren't we, when it comes to well-being and leadership?
Well, we can be. I think generally there are more isolated pockets of bad practice. I see a lot more decent sergeants and inspectors running response teams than I do awful ones. And we know who the awful ones are, to be honest with you, because you'll do a handover with them and they'll be the phantom prisoner in the cell. They'll be the 45 minutes after shift ends, is anybody coming to relieve me? I didn't even know you were out there. And you mentioned that, and it happens. And it's the hallmark for me of bad or stressed out and failing supervision when handovers are wrong, or when other people are talking out of class about their own supervision. You know where the bad pockets are. But I can say that generally, thanks, sergeants and inspectors are pretty good standard in the police.
So what are we doing with the people that aren't those small pockets? Yeah, we've all worked on teams as PCs, and there's somebody on your team who ain't doing what they should be doing, let's say. Lazy, whatever, ain't going to jobs, goes missing when the radio chimes up and stuff, and you're sat on parade with them, and you're sat there thinking, I wish somebody would do something.
You have that conversation. You. Plays into your well-being thing. We have an officer who's usually good, straight and hardworking, and the performance has just dropped off the cliff. They're not shouting up for stuff, and that's a really good diagnostic. When something comes on the radio, is there patrol free? They're never the patrol free. They're spending more and more time in the office on bits of crappy paperwork that are taking too long on the paperwork and just not getting out. And we had that conversation with the officer, myself and the other sergeant. We need to talk to you. You know, your performance has gone off a cliff. What's wrong? And it turns out that behind the scenes, their home life had turned into a country and western song. It was really, really bad. And there were some health issues as well. Then you intervene and you say, right, well, we're going to get the Federation involved. We're going to get welfare involved, Occhi Health. We're going to get you some legal advice. You're going to get, in fact, a couple of times that's happened. And we're going to get this sorted out and go home and come back when you've got the first proper steps in sorting this out done. And you speak with the inspector and it gets bottomed and sorted. That's important. And they came back good. Is the other thing. When they came back and they knew the job had looked after them, their supervision had looked after them, because there was a real proper need.
It's very easy to go straight to the table thumping mode, isn't there? We are understanding there's sometimes where you do need to give the curly finger to people. And as a supervisor, it's a very, very hard thing to do. And people call it an authentic conversation or a meeting without coffee or whatever. The first time you do it, it's horrendous.
No whipping boy, no golden child. If somebody's done something or is not doing something, slacking off on the shift, the rest of the shift knows it.
Exactly. And the point I'll make is supervisors look at other supervisors sometimes and think, is it just me that has this issue with giving someone a bollocking?
Finally, as a result of the Home Office review, and this causes me a bit of frustration, is that as a result of that now, we're going to introduce a police covenant, next step to provide comprehensive and meaningful lasting support. And then from that, we're having a service improvement and stress reduction program. I mean, are we really at the point where we need to do all these surveys to know what's wrong with policing from the inside out? We know the answers. We're wasting time we don't have.
Is there going to be a poster up in the parade room that says, you there, don't have any more stress?
Yeah, we know what the problems are. There's been a lot of research done. There's been a lot of questionnaires and surveys, and to the point where I think we mentioned previously, survey fatigue has probably set in with most officers now.
We just need a will to act.
We do.
That's what we need.
Money. Cold, hard cash. More cops, more stations, more civilian stuff, more CPS, more courts. You know, just let's kind of unscrew the criminal justice system, because it's screwed.
It's help, isn't it? Someone take this load off my back.
And it doesn't help, does it, that, I mean, it was really interesting, wasn't it, yesterday? I think the government was saying that they've written to the chief constables, they want 400 cells to house prisoners because they don't have any room for them. And the reason they don't have any room for them because the barristers went on strike. What a load of rubbish.
Is that up container?
They're right? Calling it up safeguard now because that's nicer.
Did it used to be called container?
It used to be called container, which was prosaic and
free overtime, that wasn't it?
It was, but
how many people want to do overtime now? It's a nightmare trying to get people to do overtime. They just want to go home.
This container to safeguard, it's like when they changed wind scale to Sellafield. It's a slightly nicer name for the same thing. Have we got 400 free cells? That's the first thing, because we've been closing them for the last 10-15 years, or even the mothball ones have now largely gone. We've got our big custody containment facilities.
There'll be another nice little contract for Serco, maybe.
When the holes appear in other services and things fall through, there's always the police underneath.
Paramilitary social worker of last resort, yes.
Oh, you get in trouble for saying that.
I coined it. It's my phrase.
But I think, you know, to finish off, there's problems. And if they are not fixed quickly, we don't need any more surveys or programmes or covenants. If these problems aren't fixed, it will break.
I think the capacity of leadership to make things better is nearing its marginal limits now. It talks about the selling of hope What's the job of the leader? It's to sell hope. I think we've sold all the hope we're going to sell for now. I don't think leadership is magic beans that will suddenly make the police more productive. We're at bank full load, to use a sort of fluvial geometry term. There's no, you can't fit any more water in the river. We're done. Leadership's taking you as far as it's going to take you, I think, with this, with the situation the police is in. It's money or nothing now. That's my view.
Just for me to wrap up, there's one thing that did assist me when I started out being a leader. I know people read this book and read that book. Don't change who you are. Find the book that fits you rather than you fit the book. But it was Turn the Ship Around by David Marquet. Great book about empowering your staff and how David Marquet, as the captain of a nuclear submarine, did such thing and the dividends he got from it. Or you can just search for David Marquet or Lead the Leader on YouTube, and there's a 2-minute overview of his Lead the Leader program, and I'd thoroughly advise any prospective leader, just give it 2 minutes of your time.
Other self-help books are available.
The Thin Blue Mind with Bradshaw, Horton and Thomas. Policing insights and opinion.
Well, that's it for this week. Thank you for joining us. This podcast is in partnership with Policing TV, the leading policing media channel. So until the next time and the next podcast, take care.